Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest OIES podcast. This one is being brought to you by the GAS programme. My name is James Henderson. I'm Head of GAS Research at OIES. And with me today, I have my colleagues Jack Sharples and Mike Fullwood. And we're going to talk about the outlook for global gas markets. Given the sensitivity of some of the things we're going to talk about, I should mention that today's date is the 23rd of May, and we're talking in the morning at about 10:30. But with that said, gentlemen, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay, well, look, we haven't spoken, the three of us, for about a month. I've been away on holiday, and now I'm back. So, Mike, bring me up to date, please, with where we are on gas prices, what's happened in the last month, and where's the market sentiment at the moment?
Yes, thank you. I think when we did the last recording, we were talking about the probability or likelihood of the TTF sort of month-ahead price going below the magical $10 a million BTU, or it's around about 30 euros a megawatt hour, just above that. And what we said is there's a strong likelihood it probably would go below the $10 level for at least a month. We haven't seen it for at least a month yet, but as of last night's closing, the TTF price month ahead was $9.2, and then this morning it's below the magical 30 euros a megawatt hour. So it's sort of happening, and I think if we see the rest of this month, the June sort of price month ahead, if that settles around about $9 rest of the month, we might just about squeeze below an average below $10 for June. So the sentiment is still, I think, pushing for sort of lower prices. And I think Jack will probably talk a bit about the sort of European supply-demand situation. The forward curve is looking at prices less than $10 through August. But there's still sort of downward pressure on prices from the supply-demand situation, both Europe and globally. And we'll come on to the details of that.
Indeed, yes. We'll come back to that towards the end of the podcast, and we'll sort of assess whether we think the market is being sort of over-optimistic in terms of supply-demand balance or not. But Jack, let's start with a few of the fundamentals, why don't we, and talk about supply into Europe. Why don't we start with Russia? It's becoming less and less important, but what have the flows been over the past month or so?
So the flows have remained fairly flat. Close to the year-to-date average, so that's 1st of January to the 20th of May, around 60 million cubic metres per day. Now, I think what's quite interesting about this is how much we've lost year-on-year in the year-to-date. So that total supply in the year-to-date is about 8.5 BCM, down from 40 BCM that Europe received in the same period last year, and close to 60 BCM that we received in that period in 2021. So year on year, Europe has already lost 31.5 BCM of Russian pipeline gas. Now, if those flows remain steady at around 60 million cubic metres per day for the rest of the year, then Europe will receive around 22 BCM of Russian pipeline gas in 2023, down from 63 BCM last year and down from 142 BCM in 2021. So with that in mind, a year on year decline of around 40 BCM does seem a realistic proposition. In terms of the deliveries by routes, they're fairly evenly spread still between Ukrainian transit to Central Europe and deliveries to Southeast Europe via Turkish Stream and Turkey.
Yeah, certainly when you make those annual comparisons, it really brings it home, doesn't it? I mean, you know, flows might have been flat for the last 3 or 4 months, but actually year on year, we're talking about some very significant declines. Let's move on to North Africa. What's happening there, particularly, you know, supplies from Algeria, but also, I guess, you might want to mention Azerbaijan, actually, in this little comment as well.
Indeed. Well, as always, no news is good news regarding the stable flow of a solid 30 million cubic metres per day from Azerbaijan into southeastern Europe at the Turkey-Greece border. From North Africa, there's some minor good news. In the past 3 days, pipeline flows from Libya to Italy surpassed 15 million cubic metres per day for the first time since September 2020. Now, that's the equivalent of about 5.5 BCMA, although obviously it's far from certain that the flows are going to continue at that level. For comparison, flows have averaged around 8 million cubic meters per day since December 2020, so the current flows are roughly double what has been normal for the last 2.5 years. Regarding Algeria, we've seen relatively stable flows to Spain, pretty similar to a month ago when we last recorded this podcast, but we have seen strong fluctuations in Algerian flows to Italy, driven really by spreads between prompt hub prices and the long-term contract offtake prices, the latter reflecting a combination of the front month index and some oil indexation in there as well. Now, the current discount of prompt prices in relation to those LTC prices probably drove the sharp decline in Algerian flows to Italy at the beginning of May. After then rising to a peak of around 85 million cubic meters per day in mid-May, those flows have since dropped back below 60 million cubic meters a day. So there is relatively substantial spare capacity on the pipeline from Algeria to Italy should the market call on it.
Okay, and what about our friends in Norway? I mean, they've been producing at pretty much maximum capacity for quite some time. Any sign of maintenance sort of kicking in and reducing flows at all?
There is indeed. Your question is a prescient one. So as recently as mid-April, Norwegian flows to Europe were in excess of 340 million cubic meters per day, which is pretty close to what we estimate to be the maximum capacity for Norwegian production and transportation. However, since then, flows have declined substantially to just over 220 million cubic meters per day on the 20th of May, so 3 days ago. Substantial maintenance is taking capacity offline until mid-June and to a lesser extent until the first week of July. Then we will see some lighter maintenance in early August, becoming more substantial from late August through to mid-September. So for context, Norway has around 330 million cubic meters per day of gas processing capacity at its three main processing plants, relative, again, as I say, to what we estimate total system capacity to be around 350. Now, at present, 125 million cubic meters per day of processing capacity is offline for maintenance, as is just under 100 million cubic meters per day of gas production capacity. The schedule of the plant maintenance, which is published on the Gasco website, does suggest substantial maintenance and capacity reductions also in terminals that receive Norwegian pipeline gas, both in the UK and the EU, particularly Easington and Dunkirk. So in short, I would estimate that the fluctuations in Norwegian pipeline supply this summer will really be driven by maintenance and capacity restrictions rather than by counterparty long-term contract nominations. So obviously this is in sharp contrast to the flows from Algeria to Italy, where substantial spare capacity exists on the Transmed pipeline, but that's, you know, the fluctuations are being driven by the counterparty nominations.
Okay, so finally some maintenance in Norway. I guess that's good news for the longevity of the system. So, but declining flows, but not having a big impact on prices, obviously. Let's come then to LNG send-out. I mean, obviously LNG has been the huge balancing item over the last 12 to 18 months. So what's going on there?
Well, send out from the European regas terminals, so that's EU plus UK, continues to be high, averaging around 446 million cubic meters per day in the first 3 weeks of May. So that's the same level that we saw in February, and around 20 million cubic meters per day less than in April last month. Since the beginning of November last year, LNG send out has averaged 447 million cubic meters per day. So that volume is 7 times greater than the amount of pipeline gas that Europe has received from Russia in the same period. And indeed, the LNG send-out that we're getting now represents more supply than Europe received from Russia by pipeline between November and May in winter 2019-20 and winter 2020-21, at a time when Russia was the single largest source of supply to the European market. In terms of the stocks held at European regas terminals, capacity utilization peaked at the start of effectively the start of winter last year on the 31st of October at 75% of the tanks being full and fell to a low of about 47% in mid-March. Since then, stocks have recovered to a quite healthy 65% of capacity. In the second half of last year, consistently high stock holding, so 60% of capacity or higher, was a consequence of continued robust supply despite relatively high send-out rates. So depending on dynamics in the wider LNG market, the same could happen in the summer of 2023, which again could have a dampening effect on prices, that the LNG cargoes are coming in, the tanks are pretty well stocked, and LNG is continuing to be sent out.
Okay, that's interesting stats on the high stock holdings, but also on the place of LNG relative to Russian gas in the European market, which just underlines the dramatic transformation we've seen over the last 12 to 18 months. We'll come back to storage overall though at the end and the end of the podcast. Jack, one final thing before I turn to Mike. You know, what does all this supply tell us about implied demand in Europe?
Well, for the first 3 weeks of May, it's averaged 763 million cubic meters per day, which is down from about 838 million cubic meters per day year on year. So it's a decline of about 75 million cubic meters per day, or about 9%. The level of demand in May so far is slightly lower than, in fact, the level of demand in June of last year, which is a much more summery month, for want of a way of putting it. I would suggest that certainly here in Northwest Europe, it's not been particularly warm, but gas-fired power demand has come under pressure from stronger wind and solar performance. And obviously, industrial demand does remain curbed by the relatively high prices.
Okay, interesting. So, yeah, as you say, we're about a month ahead in terms of kind of summer demand, which is another dampening effect on prices. Mike, let me come back to you. So we talked a little bit about how LNG send-out in Europe is dramatically higher. What's going on in the global LNG market? And, you know, is there lots and lots of LNG available for Europe, or are we starting to see pressure build on the supply side?
Yeah, there's still, the bottom line, still quite a lot of LNG available for two reasons. One is supply is continuing to rise. At the beginning of the year, we were expecting supply to rise around about sort of 4.5%. A couple of things have knocked that back a little bit. Sakhalin looks like it's going in for extended maintenance again. The Darwin plant in Australia is probably going to close next month for a couple of years while they get a bit more gas to put into it. That's a bit sooner than we thought. Not Nigeria feed gas looking a bit weak. So we're probably looking at a 4 to 4.5% rise in supply this year. The rise in supply is not all translated into being delivered to the markets yet. So if we look at exports leaving the plants, they're rising at a faster rate than the imports arriving at the plants, eventually, because they all arrive. So there's sort of quite a lot of LNG floating around waiting to be delivered. So supply is still higher than last year and probably going to get stronger as the year progresses. The other side of the coin is what's happening to demand outside Europe. Starting with the Asian markets, Asia's just got back by the end of April to sort of the same level as it was in 2022, but it's a very mixed picture. The Southeast Asian countries are still looking very strong. Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Singapore, all growing, and Philippines joined the club last month, got its first cargo after many years of trying, shall we say. And then if we're looking at the South Asian markets, India, Pakistan begin to pick up, Bangladesh not quite as much. But the weakness is in Japan and Korea. They're sort of well down now, last couple of months on last year, so there's a lot of weakness there. China is just about getting its head above last year's levels. It's not rebounding as strongly as some people were saying, and that's probably back on the basis of economic activity and possibly a negative reaction to higher prices, or that's sort of receding away. Outside the Asian markets, it's really Central South America, Brazil, Chile still weak because of the increased hydro. Middle East is also down a little bit. So everywhere is basically weak in terms of demand outside Southeast Asia, India, Pakistan, obviously Europe. Europe's getting the benefit of the rise in supply being much faster than growing demand outside Europe.
So it's interesting that single-digit prices don't really appear, other than in Southeast Asia, to be feeding into increased demand. Other factors seem to be outweighing that in terms of, you know, dragging LNG away.
Yeah, I mean, Southeast Asia is just continued growth. I mean, I'm not sure it's that particularly price sensitive, some of the markets there, except maybe Thailand, but they're back in buying spot gas now. Europe is the most price sensitive market, but the coal price has sort of come down in line with the gas price. So we're kind of, in terms of competitiveness between the two fuels, they're sort of on a parity with each other to some extent. So we're not seeing the real switching. And obviously prices, as we said at the beginning, have just come down back into single figures. So maybe we need to see a little bit more of prices coming back down, staying sustainably in single figures to cause a rebound in demand in markets like China and other Asian markets.
And what's been happening in Japan and Korea specifically? I mean, you mentioned that they're particularly weak. Is that a return of nuclear or what's going on?
A lot of it's to do with the nukes, both in Korea and Japan. That's caused the weakness there. And it also looks a little bit on economic activity as well. And sort of at the margin, the coal price there is still probably cheaper than the sort of the gas price. So it is a lot of it's to do with the nuclears sort of coming back on, sort of shaving a little bit off the growth in LNG demand.
Okay, and you mentioned Sakhalin and maintenance there. What's the specific story around Russian LNG? Is it still producing strongly and you know, getting LNG out to the market?
Yeah, I mean, Sakhalin has been producing until its maintenance comes along, which will be later this year, is been producing at some maximum levels, and Yamal, the Novatek one, has as well. So, and obviously, and we may come back to this, a lot of the Yamal Novatek gas has been coming to Europe, specifically sort of Spain, France, Belgium, Netherlands, basically.
Okay. Well, look, Jack, on that topic of Russian LNG, you know, there has been some talk. I mean, Russian LNG into Europe has been the kind of unspoken kind of delivery, if you like. A lot of focus on the pipeline exports from Russia, but actually Russian LNG has been arriving in some significant quantities. But there's now been talk about possible bans on Russian LNG, or if not bans, then kind of certainly limiting supply. Can you give us an update on what's actually going on around Russian LNG and the EU response to it?
Yeah, sure. And you mentioned that the Russian LNG is arriving in not unsubstantial quantities. I mean, I think we're at a stage now where the cargoes from Yamal are pretty well comparable in volume to the amount of pipeline gas that Europe is getting from Russia, if you exclude Turkey from the equation. But at the end of March, an EU proposal was made to allow any EU member state to prevent, for a fixed period of time, any network user from bidding for capacity on either pipelines or regasification capacity at LNG terminals to bring gas into the EU from either Russia or Belarus. Now, I think the point of this is that such a proposal would be easier to pass than EU-wide sanctions banning Russian pipeline gas or LNG outright, because it wouldn't require unanimity. It just gives member states the legal option. Also in March, the Spanish energy minister, Teresa Ribera, wrote to Spanish LNG importers asking them not to sign new contracts for Russian LNG once the existing contracts expires. And we're seeing something similar in the Netherlands, where the government has asked, has already set their sights really on phasing out Russian LNG, again with the energy ministry asking firms not to sign new contracts for Russian LNG. And indeed at Eemshaven, the new import infrastructure in the Netherlands, Russian LNG is already prohibited from being unloaded and stored. Now, in terms of who are the real players, who is of importance here regarding Russian LNG imports into Europe, in the first 4 months of the year, the Netherlands, Belgium, France and Spain collectively imported just over 5 million tonnes of Russian LNG from the Yamal terminal, while the rest of the EU collectively only imported 0.2 million tonnes. Now, of that big four of the Netherlands, Belgium, France and Spain, the Netherlands only imported 0.3 million tonnes. So actually the big players really are Belgium, France and Spain, which each imported between 1.2 and 2 million tonnes. So clearly the decisions taken by governments in Brussels, Paris and Madrid on whether to make use of this EU proposal, if it passes, will have the greatest impact on the volume of Russian LNG coming to Europe. In terms of how they might feel about this, clearly the Spanish government has made its position clear. But regarding France and Belgium, it's quite notable that during the winter, the re-exports from Zeebrugge in Belgium are equivalent to about a third of the volume received from Russia, mostly re-exported to China. And so it would be interesting to see if the proposed ban would prevent those cargoes from Yamal LNG being unloaded into the Zeebrugge storage tanks, ready for then being reloaded onto LNG carriers destined for Asia. With regard to France, we should also remember that TotalEnergies does have and has retained its 20% stake in Yamal LNG, which proved highly profitable in 2022. So given the revenues from re-exports from Zeebrugge, the transshipment activities there, and the TotalEnergies stake in Yamal LNG, I would suggest that perhaps France and Belgium could be the last holdouts for the imports of Russian LNG, while maybe other EU governments push for supply contracts to roll off and maybe even bans on the booking of capacity for regasifying LNG in Russia. So taking all that together, I wouldn't be surprised if rather than an outright and blanket EU ban on Russian LNG, we saw the Russian LNG supply contracts rolling off and not being renewed, in addition to varying different responses from different EU member states in terms of the proposed ban on the booking of regas capacity. So the result would likely be a steady decline in Russian LNG flows to Europe over time, rather than a sudden cliff-edge halt to those supplies.
Okay, interesting. And you mentioned pipeline supply there as well. Can I just ask you now about the suggestion, if you like, that the EU might look to close down export pipelines from Russia where flows had already been reduced to zero, and or otherwise limit any potential for an increase in Russian flows through pipelines. Where are we with that right now? And is there any likelihood that there will be progress on that issue?
So this really concerns the Nord Stream pipeline, which obviously was reduced in capacity throughout last summer due to the issues at the Portovaya compressor station and the turbines and sanctions, and then definitively taken offline by the explosions. But it also concerns the Yamal Europe pipeline that brings Russian gas, or pre-crisis brought Russian gas, to Poland and Germany via Belarus. That pipeline was stopped as a result of Polish and Russian sanctions and counter-sanctions. So from an EU perspective, it seems that the idea of adding the permanent closure of those pipelines, or should I say preventing the restart of those pipelines, to the 11th sanctions package, which is currently under negotiation, from what I've read, does not appear to be gaining much traction, hence the idea of allowing EU member states to take action individually.
Okay, so perhaps that won't happen, but I mean, still we have flows lower. And another EU kind of, not proposal, now in action, Mike, coming back to you, is in reaction, if you like, to the security of supply question, is this joint purchasing agreement, which now has, I think, been implemented for the first time. Can you just bring us up to speed on how that's working and what, if any, the impact has been?
Yeah, yes, I mean, it was this time last week, I think, that Vice President Maros Sefcovic announced the outcome of the first sort of tender. It's called a joint purchasing platform. I don't think it really is quite that. But I think it's, to be fair to the EU, it's probably one of the successes of the sort of the energy crisis, is it basically the aggregated demand from sort of smaller, more remote countries, landlocked countries and smaller industrial buyers, to about 11.6 BCM. It's basically they're buying flat gas on a sort of monthly basis, and then received proposals from 25 supply companies amounting to more than that. And then the service provider Prisma sort of matched about 10.9 BCM of volume. Most of it was pipeline gas, a little bit was sort of LNG. So to be fair, I think it's been reasonably successful and not actually a bad idea that smaller buyers aggregate demand. I mean, Sefcovic said this is a remarkable success for an instrument that did not exist some 5 months ago. The Commission has played its role as aggregator and matchmaker, and that is for the parties to conclude their agreements. Essentially, it's not really joint gas purchasing. It's more like a dating app, basically. You're matching buyers and sellers. So it's sort of the Tinder for the EU gas business, I think, is one way of sort of describing it. But to be fair to the EU, I think it's been reasonably successful, a reasonably sensible idea. Smaller buyers to come in and aggregate their demand. I don't think it's had a material effect on the market, and we probably won't find out what sort of prices they're sort of negotiating at, but I imagine it's probably close related to TTF.
Okay, a Tinder for the European gas market. That's an image that's a conjure with, I think. But as we come towards the end of the podcast, I just want to touch on a couple of kind of major events that have happened. Jack, let me come back to you first. You know, at the G7, which has just taken place in Japan, there was some talk that there would be an announcement about further European action on Russian gas imports. Nothing too dramatic appeared to happen, but what's your interpretation of that G7 meeting?
So a week ago, reports emerged that a proposal would be tabled at the G7 summit in Hiroshima to prevent the reopening of avenues previously shut down by Russia's weaponization of energy, at least until there is a resolution of the conflict. So again, this is very much as you asked about regarding the EU measures to take those pipelines that have been shut down and to keep them permanently shut down. Now, the proposal wasn't included in the wording of the statements following the summit, which obviously concluded on the 21st of May. In terms of the rationale behind it, I think one unnamed official pretty much hit the nail on the head by saying that this is maybe about giving confidence to those who are investing in LNG regasification infrastructure in Europe, who maybe are concerned that at some point the taps may get turned back on and Europe could be flooded with relatively cheap Russian gas, driving LNG out the market and rendering those investments redundant. I think that's probably unlikely to happen, but I think that the fact that these proposals are being issued pretty well shows the direction in which the wind is blowing and that governments want to make sure that people feel secure in making these investments in alternative sources of supply.
Well, talking about giving confidence to the market, Mike, let me come to you now, because the other big conference that took place, and certainly from a gas perspective, was FLAME. And as I understand it, there was quite a lot of conversation around the need for long-term contracts to provide confidence to suppliers and that European buyers need to rethink their strategy. Can you give us an update on how the conversation went and what your take on it was?
Yeah, there was some pushing, I think, mainly from some of the US suppliers or people with US projects who want, obviously, to get their projects off the ground, is that the look at the Europeans to come in. So if you want to buy gas, then just don't buy it on the spot market. If you want projects to come on and supply you on a secure basis, then please enter 20-year contracts, as the Asians have been doing, and the Chinese in particular have sort of continued to do that. So I think that was where the sort of push was coming from. But I think the European buyers are still in a sort of a little bit sort of schizophrenic mode, is that they've been encouraged to go out and buy gas to fill the loss of Russian supplies, but only until demand collapses in line with Repair EU, if it ever does. So they want gas for 5 to 10 years, but they don't want it for 20 years. So I think there's this little bit of a dichotomy still. But we're not talking about contracts, long-term contracts are going to come into being this year, next year, or even 2-3 years' time. Any contracts, 20-year contracts now, would be for LNG coming on in 28, 29 at the earliest. So it's sort of after the huge surge of LNG, which will sort of begin towards the end of next year, when we expect to get Arctic Train 1 on. Probably Golden Pass starting up. This is the start of the surge, it's sort of the back end of next year.
Okay, well, thank you for that. We're coming now to the end. We've got a couple of minutes left of the podcast. And the one thing we haven't talked about is our favourite topic, which is storage levels in Europe. So we'll use that to conclude. Jack, let me start with you. How are storage levels in Europe, and what's your interpretation of what that means for the coming summer and winter?
If we go back to the end of winter, we obviously ended the winter with very healthy stocks. Since the 1st of April, storage injections have been slower year on year. So between the 1st of April and the 20th of May, Europe injected about 10.5 BCM this year, compared to about 16 BCM in the same period last year. Now, that's not really surprising given the tighter market conditions, but also the fact that we were starting from a higher stock holding. So total European stocks on the 20th of May were 69 BCM, which puts us just over 25 BCM higher year on year. Now, if the storage injection rate continues to be slower year on year throughout the summer, then obviously the extent to which stocks are higher than they were 12 months earlier will diminish as we go through the summer, possibly leading to a convergence point with stocks eventually becoming similar to a year earlier by the time we reach autumn. So at the moment, the situation looks fairly manageable, let's say. In the previous podcast, I highlighted the fact that in Q2, we were going to see the last big differential year on year in terms of Russian pipeline gas supply, because obviously by the time we got to Q3 and Q4 last year, Russian pipeline supply had come off substantially. So the year on year decline won't be so sharply felt by the time we get to the later part of summer. So I think we're probably feeling that a little bit at the moment in terms of the storage injections. but hopefully we'll maintain our trajectory and get storage nicely full by the end of summer. I think the only open question for me is at what point we do reach full stocks, because of course if we get there by early September, then, and it turns out to be quite a mild start to the winter, then we could see some real downward pressure on prices if storage capacity isn't there to absorb the volumes. Conversely, last year we carried on injecting through to mid-November, but we were only able to do so because it was very mild in October and the first half of November. If that doesn't happen this year, there's still substantial storage capacity available by the time we get to, say, the end of September, but the weather turns much colder, then we could end up starting the winter proper with storage not being entirely full. So there definitely is a sort of a corridor within which we are operating.
Okay, Mike, let me come to you for the last word. And I think your word of the last few months has been benign. So on a scale of benignness, if I may, from 1 to 10, where are we at the moment? And what do you think the risks are? In which direction are the major risks, do you think, for the market over the next few months?
Yeah, I guess we're almost at our benignest, if that is such a word, in terms of the market sentiment. And I think there are sort of risks. I mean, just coming back to the storage point, I think the economics for storage now look the best they've been for years. If you're putting gas in June, July, August, and taking it out in November, December, January, hedging that, you're looking in a sort of $5-6 a million BTU margin. So the incentive is there to fill storage in the next 3 months. All the risks again are sort of on the downside. I mean, notwithstanding the fact that we're now in single digit prices, the market still is very tight. And the energy export plants are operating at effectively sort of 98% of available capacity. They're sending out almost as much as they possibly can. And it would take much more of a supply shock or a sudden sharp increase in demand somewhere to completely turn the market upside down. We've been saying this for 3 or 4 months that everything was pushing prices down a lot, but one shock could completely reverse that. So I think the risks are definitely on the downside in terms of a lot higher prices. And it's difficult to see any sort of good news putting sort of further downward pressure on prices other than the general drift downwards we're seeing.
Okay, right. So we're at as benign as we're going to get by the sound of it. But okay, thanks. Thank you, gentlemen, for your contributions. Thanks, Jack. Thanks, Mike. As always, I'm sure we will reconvene in a month or so and review where we've got to. But for the time being, thanks to you. Thanks to everyone for listening. Please take care of yourselves and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.